this week's edition of Books and Booze. We're here with Rios de la Luz. This is Renee. We are being brought to you this week by Keeping the Record by Travis Richardson, and we'll talk more about that at the end. I fucked that up, but this is Renee again, and I'm drinking a really terrible Mike's Harder Strawberry Lemonade, and I don't recommend it. Rios, how are you doing, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm a little tired, but I'm doing well. I am actually drinking a smoothie. It's cranberry, blueberry, and I think there's like protein in it or something. But yeah, I'm being healthy, I guess. I don't know.
I wish I had a smoothie right now. This lemonade's terrible.
I used to have a blender, and I lost it. And I get really sad about it now. Whenever I hear people talking about smoothies and stuff, I'm like,
oh no,
I don't have a blender anymore. Like, it's, you know, a $20 purchase at Walmart, but still.
Yeah. That means you'd have to go out and, yeah.
That means I have to go to a store and deal with fine things. Ah.
What are you drinking, Jessica?
What am I drinking? I am drinking a rum and Coke because I bought a bottle of rum to do our shots challenge that we were doing, and so it's still in the house, and I have to do something with it.
You want to hear something exciting? I'm going to make my mom do shots for our thing.
You're going to make your mom do shots? That's so crazy.
My mom, I was like, are you going to do it? And she was like, well, I was going to pretend with iced tea. I was like, no, you can't pretend with iced tea. She goes, well, if I donate money, I don't have to do shots. I go, no, if you donate money, you have to take one shot. If you don't donate money, you have to take two. She was like, what?
Yeah.
It'll be great because my mom's super lightweight. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
I might just keep the camera rolling for a few minutes afterwards to see what happens.
That's a really good idea.
So yeah, kicking off, a few episodes ago, we had Constance Fitzgerald on, and she was talking about Lady Box, and mm-hmm. Rios has, I don't know, you're not in it, your zine is in it. Sorry. As terrible as the Mike's Harder Lemonade is, it works. It gets the job done, apparently. Anyway, your zine is in it. Mm-hmm. We had the opportunity to check it out. It's pretty awesome. My first question is, it's a double question. One, how did you come to be involved in the Lady Box project? And two, when you're putting together the zine, was it like a collaborative effort, like you and Constance talked about it, or is it something you kind of like, you came up with a concept on your own? Like, what was the process?
The reason I became involved with Lady Box was I met Constance at BizarroCon last year, and we were eating dinner together, and she was talking about this project that she and Cameron had recently discussed, and we talked about feminism, we just got along really well, so it just started off as her and I becoming friends, and then she invited me, she asked me if I wanted to be a part of the project, and I said, of course, because she also told me other people she had in mind, and, you know, for me, it's an honor to be part of this set with the women that are also a part of it. And then you had a second part of the question, didn't you? with my own zine. So for that, it was literally like Constance just gave us as much artistic freedom as we wanted. So the zine idea for my personal one, it was just basically what I wanted to put into it. So I wanted to make it Loteria themed, so I did. I wanted to put, you know, stories that incorporate Spanish into them, so I did. It was basically we were just free to put anything that we wanted into it.
Awesome.
So,
I keep interrupting.
You go.
Okay, I'll go. just scrolling. Okay, I have to, I guess, preface this. We got, you know, like a review copy, and it's like a Word document for your.
Yeah.
And well, I mean that's fine, but I'm saying I'm scrolling through, and people are like, "What? I don't have a physical copy yet." I've said that this is one of those things that if I don't get it, I'm going to be really unhappy in my life. But anyway, just really quickly scrolling through it and looking at the aesthetics of it, and there's pictures in it, I just immediately started getting goosebumps. Like, I just love the look of it. I love everything about it.
Thank you.
I'm so
excited.
Thank
you so much.
Oh, God, you're welcome. the first... Hold on. I have to find all my little notes here. The first thing I wanted to mention that hit me immediately was just a tiny little paragraph, I guess, called Tarot, about the mom reads tarot, and then there's the images and everything through that, and how she hides it from the Jehovah's Witnesses. For some reason, that stuck out to me so much. And can you tell us a little bit about the tarot and why that's in there and those kind of references?
Yes, of course. So my mother, she did read tarot when I was younger, and that's actually from an experience that I had. I remember seeing the death card and being terrified because I thought, you know, my mother just dealt her own death. I literally thought that's what that meant. So after that, I was praying like as much as I could, you know, before I went to bed, for her to stay alive. Cause I thought it was a literal thing. I didn't realize, you know, the symbolism in the cards and everything. So, this is something that I pulled from experience. And, that's what a lot of the zine is. It's just different experiences that I was pulling from.
There's a line at the end of that little tarot section that says, I prayed to God for no ghosts and good hair, but most of all, I prayed that it would let my mother live to see me learn her crafts. Mm-hmm. And that brought up this idea that when I was really young, like every night, I would just pray that I wouldn't have nightmares. For some reason, that was my biggest worry in life, which I guess was amazing. I was just like, and it was a specific mantra. And I would say, I hope that I have good dreams or no dreams. And that was all I would say. And I would repeat it a few times, good dreams or no dreams, good dreams or no dreams. And so that's what that reminded me of, just that kind of simplistic idea when you're little that you can make these things happen somehow by just saying them or wishing them into whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And I did do that as well. Yeah, I would, like, have a pattern for what I asked for every night. And actually, part of it was good hair. I know that sounds ridiculous, but, you know, part of it was, like, to tame my hair because it's the curls that I have. You know, that's actually something as a Latina, like, having to deal with the things that's going on the top of my head, and it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, people make a huge ordeal of hair, but that was one of them. And then I did pray for no ghosts as well, because for a while, although my mom also read tarot, she also was taking us to Jehovah Witness halls. And they would come over, like there'd be a couple of women and girls that would come over and, you know, teach me and my little sister Bible stories. But one of the women, I remember her telling me that, the way she said it is she said, angels are everywhere. That's what she told me. But the way I remember interpreting it as a kid was, oh, shit, there are ghosts everywhere. Like, ghosts are watching me, like, all the time. So that was the reason that became part of, like, my praying mantra as well.
Oh, my gosh. I always think it's weird, too, like, when you're a kid that someone could tell you something, like, pretty, like, even, it's not supposed to sound nice, isn't it? Like, oh, angels are everywhere. But then, like, your kid mind is like, oh, my fucking God, they're watching me. Like, why?
Yeah.
Because I remember we did, like, this thing where I have, like, really sketchy memories of it because I was, like, in the third grade or whatever. But we went to this camp that was run by a Native American family, and they told us all these, like, common I don't know, like their legends that they have or whatever. Mm-hmm. And one was about like the watcher. And it's supposed to be like, again, it's supposed to be comforting. It's supposed to be like, oh, like you're always being looked out for. But then we're like camping at night. I'm like totally fucking freaked out. Like this
yeah,
image
yeah,
of just
absolutely.
An eye.
Yeah.
You just feel better at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I think the conclusion that we can reach right now is that we've literally all been there on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think that was something that struck me about your section of the scene was that there were so many things that were completely relatable. And I think some of that is your style of writing that just it just screams at you. It's just right there in your face, and it's honest and real, and I was really affected by that. But even – I don't know how to say what I want to say. But anyway, regardless of the protagonist or whoever is telling the story, you know, I'm not Latina. I don't have the Spanish origins. But it was still completely relatable just in a human way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's something that was that really stood out to me was that this is just for everyone, and it's so many universal ideas that are gonna, I think, really touch people. I'm excited for people to see it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was gonna comment on the writing style too, because I did feel like it was really approachable and relatable, but also like very. I think a lot of the scenes were very beautifully written. But not like in a like a purple prose kind of way, but like you could relate to it while at the same time being like really like touched by just the way the words were written, I thought personally.
Yeah, thank you. I'm gonna be saying thank you like the whole time, so just
she's so polite. I just told her, and I feel like I'm being like a fangirl, basically. Here.
No,
I just thought you said that because I was gonna feel bad if I said it, and you're like, because I always do that to you.
Yeah.
I always brought her out for the stuff she tells me, like in our little chat during the show.
Yeah. No.
No, but like I said, Jessica and I both, like we were talking about it, we're both like really. Like blown away by the zine and the two short stories you sent, and I don't know, it's kind of like hard to put a finger on like exact things or exact reasons. There's just a very like open, cool like feel about it, where even the stuff that like Jessica was saying, like not having the same experiences per se, but it feels really mm-hmm. universal and it feels really personal.
Yeah.
So I know you said like a lot of it's based on your experience, and I know like obviously you're bringing your heritage into it and you're doing that purposefully. Do you like when you're doing that, in addition to like the obvious of like, hey, this is you, obviously you're going to write about it. Is there like a goal you have in mind? Are you thinking like, I want to have something out there that women like me can read and relate to? Or is it more just like, I'm going to write what I want to write, and if people relate to it, awesome.
I would say it's both. I mean, because I can, you know, I can think of specific writers that impacted me in such a way because they were writing about, being, you know, like Mexicana, like us. Sandra Cisneros, she wrote House on Mango Street and Caramelo, and reading her stuff, I mean, anytime I read any of her stuff, there's just something that comes over me, I feel like I just feel so inspired, and I feel inspired because I see this woman who's writing, you know, from a perspective that I really, really get, like, you know, she gets deep into the culture. So that is part of it for me. Like when I'm writing something, if, you know, if there are
you know, young women of color out there who can relate because that's how I write, then that's fantastic. And but also, I pull from my own childhood a lot because, you know, the awe and like the imagination that you have as a kid, like all of us can relate to that. So I you know, I don't want to be exclusionary or anything like that. But yeah, so I think it would be an element of both of those. So writing for people that can relate to me on a very specific level, but then also writing for anybody who would be willing to give my, you know, my work a chance.
Right. Well, I think it's one of those things too, like, I know we've kind of touched on this in the past, on a like more general level, about like just women in general, but like mm-hmm. we can read, like you read the stuff that come from like the majority groups and like you relate to it, and it's fine. It's not like you're like, well, this is terrible because it's about a white guy. Like, you can enjoy it even though it's about a white guy.
Yeah.
And you can relate to things about it even though it's a white guy. And so, like, obviously that's the same when you're reading about, like, a Mexicana girl. But
mm-hmm.
not everybody realizes that or
cares
about it or whatever. Like,
yeah, I think what especially as you know, people of color who are writing, I think sometimes, especially if you really are trying to write for your culture or whatever it may be, that I think there's this element of people assuming that they're not going to be able to relate or, you know, something along those lines. And I think that comes, I think the reason for that is because the assumption is that, you know, the white male voice is the default voice. So basically when you have people of color who are writing and, you know, you're assuming that one, you know, you pick the audience that you want to write for, right? Because you do have to take that into consideration. So who am I writing for?
Right.
Like, who do I want, you know, who do I want to connect with for this? But then, you know, then there's the rest of the general population that might run into your stuff, you know. But if the assumption in you know, in those folks is that the white male voice is a default voice, then, you know, something like a Sandra Cisneros book may be something that they wouldn't consider reading just because of that. So I think, yeah, for people of color that are writing, there's also, you know, obviously there's the element of race, especially if that's what they're writing about.
Right.
I've told this story, like, probably 3 times on this show, so people who've listened to the show before, I'm very sorry, but I don't care. I'm going to say it again. I had a writing instructor in college who told me that if I want my stories to be universal stories that everyone could enjoy, I have to make my protagonist a male, or else they're not universal.
No, yeah.
And I got so angry. I was like, no, that's not true. Like, my voice can be a universal voice. The only thing different about me is, like, I get a period.
How fucking stupid do you have to be to believe that? Like, honestly, though, right? Like, that there's this one group of people on the whole planet that speak for everyone. And if anybody else tries to, like, tell a story about, like, their group of people, that, well, nobody cares about that. It's like, hey, I got news for you. Like, these days, people are getting a little bit tired of, like, middle class white dudes being the protagonist of every fucking story.
Mm-hmm. And not even just in stories, you know, you get into, like, all media ever, and then it's like, yeah, it's getting a little old, y'all.
Absolutely. So, which actually, and I feel like I should say this, is one of the reasons that Renee and I have been so excited about the Lady Box Project ever since Constance told us about it on the when she was on the show. And so I made the decision. I do all of our booking. I mean, Renee helps, she tells me and all that, but I try and I keep the schedule. So I said, you know, I'm going to get all of the, I'm going to try to get all of the authors from that on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because I think it's such an awesome project, and I know, like, Lady Box is going to continue in its own imprint, and so, you know, we hope to help them get their word out and spread that. So I'm really excited. I've talked to a few so far, including yourself, that have agreed, and I think we're going to hopefully. So, listeners, stay tuned. There's going to be more Lady Box talk over the next month or two. Hooray.
We're going to be talking about Lady Day in your mind. The bomb.
Yeah.
So, okay. I had to get out my little rant about that one teacher that I'm never going to forgive. And then
no, yeah. That was a terrible thing for that person to say. Like, yeah,
on
so many levels, terrible. Like, he's a terrible human being in addition to that being terrible advice.
Yeah.
And he was a master, you know? Like, shit, what do I do now?
Right, like, well, yeah, you're like, okay, well, you and I, we're probably not going to see eye to eye.
I wanted I said real quick, who knows how quick it'll be. You did submit some of your other stories to look at, mm-hmm. and I really loved the one you sent. It was called Martian Matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
oh,
so good. It's a character who, well, it's hard for me to explain this without just giving everything that there is, because it was so well written. But it encompasses a lot of dream sequences that I think, mm-hmm. and in her dreams, she's basically exploring who she really is, which is something that she's. Maybe not that she's not comfortable with, but that society is not comfortable with, because she identifies as queer, and she uses that as an exclamation of who she is, and she's Mexicana, and she, you know, that's part of who she is, and she's fine with that, but people around her are not, and mm-hmm. so, you know, it talks a lot about, you know, in her dream world, in her dreams, she can explore these parts of herself that she can't really express otherwise. And I thought that was really, really awesome. And I know you, in the Lady Box stuff, you use dream sequences as well. Is that something that, tell me about it.
I love dream sequences, like, because, well, part of it is you can be as outrageous as you want to be, and it's still, I think, within a realm of reality, because, you know, it's something that's contained within ourselves, but I think there's so much fun to write, so that's why I have so many. Also, I enjoy creating that sort of imagery, because it's sort of like my ode to comic books, you know, like, they can get as ridiculous as they want, and you can, you know, you can see it in every panel, but when you're writing fiction, it's a whole different thing, and I think having dream sequences involved in my writing helps me sort of express, like, the things that I would want to express if I were to create a comic or something, you know, so.
Are there other ways that comic books have influenced your writing? Like, I have a confession to make. I love, like, anybody who listens to the show, I fucking love superheroes and comics and graphic novels, but, like, I came to that really late. Like,
no,
I think...
So, yeah, so did I. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, so, I mean, but with, this is also... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, like, I feel like I'm newer to comic books in general. I mean, I think I started reading them. Well, see, now that I'm getting older, I forget how much time has passed, but it's been over, I want to say 7 years now, but I still feel like I'm so new at it, or, you know, new to the medium, just because there's so much stuff that I still haven't had access to because of funds or whatever it may be. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I was like 21 or 2 when somebody, like, talks me into reading The Watchmen. Like, look, this can be enjoyable. This can be, like, deep. It's not whatever. And, like, since then, I've read a lot of graphic novels, super into superheroes, that's kind of dumb. But what I think is interesting is I feel like because I came to it as an adult, like, and I had already been writing,
mm-hmm.
I feel like I pull certain things, but I'm like, I want to try that, but writing it, you know, like, can you
absolutely.
Make that work without the images? And so I always think it's interesting when we have somebody who writes like prose, who's also into comics and graphic novels, because like, I guess I'm like, what's your perspective on like what you want to pull from that medium and translate to like what you're doing?
Well, as far as, yeah, I would say that comic books in general, and for me, particular authors have an influence on the way that I write. I'm a Grant Morrison fangirl for the rest of my life, probably. He has influenced a lot of the things that I've written. Because he, like, his comic books, when I read his comic books, sometimes I come, you know, I'll put the comic book down, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm so exhausted. Like, some of his comic books exhaust me because he puts so much into it, you know, whether it's like, okay, so now we're looking at a comic, but we're actually not really looking at this comic. You're in the comic, and now there's a character in that comic that's in another dimension, and now there's this other Earth that you're getting to know, and this is all within like an issue, and
right.
So like things like that are very, very inspirational for me, you know, just to try to create specific kinds of imagery within prose or fiction. Yeah, I think, yeah, he's definitely been a huge, huge influence. And so, yeah, I try to take elements of the things that he writes. So I love that him personally, like, he'll talk about, you know, like, magic and things of that sort. And I, you know, growing up with, you know, my mom, like I said before, like, she would read tarot. And she also cast spells for people. This is something else that she did for the people in the neighborhood. She would cast, there were love spells, I believe. So yeah, like I would see her do this stuff, you know? So I feel like I've always been connected to like a sort of magic that, as ridiculous as that sounds, you know, those are the sorts of things that I tend to pull from like comics as well. So when I see that a writer is also into these things, like I connect and then I get inspired from that as well. And I'm not sure if I'm making sense.
And that's
okay.
Like, I was thinking, because, like, I had to sit in the Social Security office all day yesterday. So I had this graphic novel that I bought, like, on a whim, God, like, 2 years ago, maybe. And I had stuck it in my glove box to take on a weekend away and then, like, forgot about it. So at the Social Security office, you're not allowed to have, like, your phone or, like, an iPad out. And I do all my reading on my tablet, so I'm like, fuck, like, what am I going to do? I'm going to sit there all day. Mm-hmm. So I got it out, and I was reading it, and it was, like, it was so good, and it was so exciting. And it's been a really, like, not a really long time, but, like, maybe, like, 9 months to a year since I read, like, a graphic novel or comics, just because, like, not for any reason. And this particular story, I'm just going to say, the book is called Punk Rock Jesus, and I totally recommend it to anybody who's, like, not really uptight about religion, because if you are, don't read it. But it's about, like, this guy who's supposed to be the clone of Jesus, and he grows up, like, believing it, and then, like, he starts to kind of realize that it's a bunch of bullshit, and then it's, because it's, like, reality TV, whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's a transformation that happens, and it starts with him, like, getting a hold of the security guard's music and, like, getting a hold of the DNA scientist's, like, books and stuff like that. So the transformation isn't visual at first. And then there's, like, this moment where, like, he's supposed to make this big public whatever. Like, I don't know what I'm trying to say, the word, but he's supposed to be out in public for a big appearance.
Right.
And, like, they don't really show what he's doing. They show him, like, getting the razor out to cut his hair, and then the next page is a full page of, like, him, like, fully punked out, like, mohawk and everything, and, like, the lead-up to that was so flawless and so amazing. It's like, it was like so fucking cool. You know, you're like, how could you possibly do that in a book? You couldn't. Like, well, for one, I don't even know if like the premise of this book, this graphic novel would work with prose, but this particular picture, like, it says everything you need to know right there. Like, you see it, and it's like, it would take you like pages to get it into prose.
Oh, yeah.
And then people would be like, okay, we really don't need to read about his clothes for three pages. You know?
Oh yeah. No, that's what, that's something that's really, really, amazing about, you know, comic book medium is you, for me, you know, there are still certain, like, very specific panels that, like, are so clear and so vivid to me, because, you know, with a comic book, you can spend a lot of time with a panel. So, like, if there's something that, like, if something, you know, if something, a climactic just happens in a comic book, like, you can stare at that panel for a long time and, like, take it in, and you're soaking in the image, but you're also, you know, working out the feelings that you may have. And yeah, I think that's, I think that's what makes them, like, fucking magical. I mean, I really do think that about, I mean, a lot of the shit that I read anyway, you know, but, I love comic books.
Yeah, no, I feel like, because now, like, I could totally, like, take us way off topic and talk to you about comics for this show.
No,
like,
I know,
I'm thinking of,
like,
all these examples now, and I'm like,
oh, yeah,
And Jessica's like, whatever.
No, Jessica, you know what you should read?
What?
Okay, sorry, go ahead. No, tell me what you loved, and then maybe it'll be what I was going to...
No. When I was younger, I was very into, like, Batman and the X-Men, and G.I. Joe, too, because my uncle was. My uncle is only 5 years older than me, and so we were raised like siblings. And so he had these comics, so naturally I loved those comics. So I was, but I haven't done any kind of comics in years and years and years. So
oh,
what
man.
Do I need?
Okay. So the something that a lot of people, like, what actually got me into comics, or I guess graphic novels, either way, was Brian K. Vaughan's Why the Last Man. David and I went to this small comic shop in Norman, Oklahoma, and the guy that works there, Rob Volmar, he recommended it to me. He said, no, I think you'll love it, because he kind of asked me, you know, the things that I'm into, and, you know, at that point, feminism was one of the things as well, and so he said, buy this, you won't regret it, and I fucking, like, now Brian K. Vaughan is seriously, like, just, I don't know if he would be one of my heroes, but yeah, actually, yes, he's one of my personal heroes, but the way that he tells stories is, it's fucking, like, fantastic. That's the only way that I can describe it. But if you start out with that, you'll want to just, like, fucking keep buying more and more graphic novels and more comic books. And but that's what really got me into that medium. So Brian K. Vaughan, and it doesn't have to be Why the Last Man. Right now he has an ongoing series called Saga. And Saga is so fucking good. Like, okay, so with Grant Morrison, after I read Grant Morrison stuff, I'll just kind of step back. And like I said, I feel a little exhausted, but I'm also, like, exhilarated, because he just, like, blew my mind in you know, some sort of way. And then with Brian K. Vaughan, he also blows my mind. But his is because, like, his storytelling is so, like, it's perfect. Like, he just has, like, this, whether, you know, it's a formula or not, like, he just has it down. Like, he knows how to make this beautiful fucking thing. Like, he'll be talking about, you know, the storyline will be, you know, maybe, like, this mass murderer going around, and, you know, who has kidnapped a baby or something like that. But the art that accompanies Saga specifically, like, is so fucking beautiful that it just blows me away. Like, every time I read a new issue of Saga.
Mm-hmm. I like
the letter Y, right?
Yes.
Why?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, why?
I went ahead and looked it up. And go ahead. No, I'm good.
I say that's my favorite thing about the, like, I don't know what you want to call it, the medium, I guess, is that, like, you can have anything going on. Like, it could be something super serious, or it could be something, like, really out there, or, like, it could be one of the super, super cheesy 1990s Iron Man comics, but then, like, all of a sudden there'll be a page in there that's just fucking gorgeous. And you're like, it's like finding, like, it's like discovering something really special, but also it does fit in with the story and it works at the same time. It's, I don't know, that's what I've grown to really appreciate about. And it's like, kind of like going back to what I was saying about the that page in Punk Rock Jesus, it's like, how could you make that happen in prose? Like, how could you go from, like, whatever story you're telling to this really, like, astounding, like, punch in the gut visual piece?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think you can.
I don't know. Yeah, I think the only thing you could do is maybe pick elements out of, you know, comic book as far as, like, imagery is concerned. But, I mean, yeah, I don't think you could get, like, maybe the feeling that you would get from an image. Because, yeah, I can think of certain panels that I looked at for a while. And, you know, for me, it was one of them is from Animal Man. And, like, I don't want to, like, give spoilers. But it's, you know, Animal Man's from, like, what, 1988 or something. But but still, you know, because people are new to comics, so they want to know. But there's this part where there's this really tragic part where the main character, he finds out that his family's been killed, you know. So obviously that's fucking traumatic. But just the way that the panel goes through, you know, his depressive state in a very specific way, and there's no dialogue. It's literally like you just see his face, and it's like getting closer and closer to, like, his eyes, and, like, his eyes are so sad. And I remember that's just something that will always stand out for me from that, you know, that specific comic. But yeah, I don't know that you could, yeah, like I said, maybe elements from, you know, or inspiration from comic books, but I don't think that, yeah, it could be recreated like it can in an image necessarily.
I think it goes back, like, I have this theory that there are most stories could be told in any medium and work, mm-hmm. but some stories need, like, one specific medium, and taking them out of it, like, hurts it. So, like, in some of these stories where you have, like, this really amazing visual that, like, adds so much depth and so much emotion for the reader and everything, like, if you pull that away, if you took that visual away, then you'll lose that, and it won't be as amazing. Mm-hmm. Especially with comic books, because, like, a lot of the shit is out there, you know? Like, if you try to just present that flat, like, here it is. But then, like, you know, I feel like, and then there's some things like, okay, if I wrote a novel and you tried to make it into a TV show, people might go like, I don't really think it's working as a TV show.
Right, because it's
even though plenty of
something else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's just, I think comic books are a really great example of that. But we are getting close on time here. Like, we have, maybe 15 minutes left or so.
Okay.
And we really wanted to talk about the research you're doing on Juarez and, like, the drug cartels and the way it's affecting the women there. Because I know you told us you were, like, in the process of writing a novella about it. And I mean, it's like, all right, here it is. So this is, I think, from your message. Over 300 women have been killed and more are missing since 1993 in Juarez. Over 60,000 people have been killed because of the drug cartels in Mexico. So I think it's obvious what drew you to the topic. Like, I read that and I'm immediately drawn to, I want to know more. So I guess the better question is, when you're doing the research and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do with it, how did you decide that you're going to write a novella?
Well, the way that I want to write it is from the perspective of women. So I'm going to have, I want the main character, one of the main characters is like a little girl, and I'm also just going to have several other female lead characters. But a novella, I mean, is to be complete, you know, just to be frank, is I've not written anything over,
3,000 words before. So that to me would be the least daunting, of things to write. So I know that's kind of like cop out answer, but so that's why I'm saying novella at this point. But I'm not sure. Like I'm really into. As far as like the research is concerned, I mean, you could obviously write a fuck ton on the subject.
Did you consider doing nonfiction?
I don't want to do nonfiction on it just because I feel that there are other folks that, you know, that would have a better grasp on the situation and just be better informed than I am, that have probably been researching the area for years, because that's where I'm pulling from. I'm pulling from research that others have done, you know, others that have gone into Juarez and interviewed families, interviewed, you know, sex workers, obviously not like people in the cartels or anything like that, but, you know, just researched the area in general. So I haven't considered nonfiction.
It's always, I feel, I don't know, this is how to put it, but like, I find it really interesting with the processes when someone's taking a real situation and translating that to fiction, especially if it's like recent, because that's very difficult for me personally to do, because I'm like, I get overwhelmed with all the real stuff. What's the experience been like? Because I feel like just the research itself would be very emotionally draining. And then to turn around and, like, get into the mindset of the characters and what's happening to them, like, are you drinking a lot or?
No. The reason I wanted one of the main characters to be a child is the child is actually she's from the future, so she can actually travel through, like, portals into the present day. So, she can travel into 2011, 12, 13, 14, but she's way ahead in time, and she is in Mexico at that point, but she's there in the future. And so I incorporated that, you know, because just like I talked about before, children have, they still have, you know, they see the world with a lot of imagination still and a lot of awe. And so I wanted to add that element to it. One of the things that I'm really adamant on not doing is romanticizing like the actual situation, you know. So I've come across other people's writing who, for example, they'll use, you know, piles of dead bodies. Piles of dead bodies of my people, basically, and that's the narrative that they use to make their story go along. Like I know I definitely want to stay away from that. I mean, I'm going to be talking about, you know, really horrific things that human beings have done to one another, but I hope to stay away from romanticizing. I don't know that. I mean, I'm only in the research process, I'm not going to make it like some happy-go-lucky thing, obviously.
Right.
Because I am going to talk about the realities of the things that are going on, but I want to make sure that I do it justice, of course, but I also want to make sure that the way that I want to write it is from the women's perspective on purpose, because, you know, when you think of this, you know, this, what is it like, this culture that's been created, that's, you know, incredibly, incredibly violent, and, you know, you don't necessarily think of, I don't necessarily think of femininity or, you know, things along those lines. Like when I think of a highly violent society, you know, I associate it with, you know, hyper-masculinity and, you know, like macho culture and, you know, who can outdo who. And So I don't necessarily want to get away from that, but I want to add a feminine perspective. And I feel that I can do that in fiction as opposed to nonfiction, and you know, to do it justice in my own way.
I kind of want to go back to what you said about romanticizing it, because I'm not sure it's something that, like, I know personally, and, like, this is, a confession. It's not a good thing. Personally, like, when I see movies or even read fiction that sort of use, like, the war on drugs and the cartels, like, as a plot point, I don't really think about it. That's not to say, like, for instance, I live in a city that has a border patrol thing, like, station in it, and there's all this, like, craziness because the kids that are coming from these Latin American countries that are being fucked by the cartels, and people mm-hmm. are, like, literally driving them away.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm aware of it, and it does hit me, like, in my heart, and it makes me emotional. But then when I'm consuming it in media and they're just sort of using it, it doesn't necessarily do that. And I was just thinking, like, I was in Baltimore, where I lived for several years, and we went to one of my favorite restaurants, is an Italian restaurant in Little Italy, which is like an expat community that's still very traditional out there. And the waitress, who's like, you know, one of the members of the family who owns the place, was telling us all about how they do these movies in the park every Friday, every summer, for, like, decades. Like, probably, I think she said, like, 30 years or something. Like, they've been doing this forever. And that the week before was the first time that they ever showed The Godfather, because all of the people, all of the older generation, hated the movie. Because they were there in the city trying to build a life for themselves, you know, opening up restaurants and, like, doing services and trying to build a community, and everyone was associating them with mobsters and gangsters, which to them, they're like, hey, I actually do have family members that are involved in that, and actually, like, my people are dying because of that, and no, it's not cool. So I just find it interesting when you have, like, somebody who's willing to actually say that, like, yeah, okay, The Godfather is super popular. Yeah, okay, the cartel storyline in Breaking Bad is super popular. But are you thinking about the real people who are dealing with it? And I don't know, I think there's something very important about, like, people who are willing to say, like, yeah, okay, it's entertaining, but are you really thinking about what it means?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, there's also a difference, you know, And I'm sure we all know this, but, you know, when you see violence in, you know, in movies and in different mediums, but to me, there's just, and yeah, it's probably because, you know, I grew up in El Paso, and, you know, you could literally see Juarez, like, you can see it, you know, there's just, like, a fucking fence there. It's not like, you know, there's no giant walls or anything like that. It's a fucking fence, so you can see it.
Yeah.
So for me, like, you know, hearing these things and yeah, it really does hit me, like, on a different level. Like, I get, you know, like, you know, with research, like, some of it, yeah, just fucking, it upsets me so much that this is going on, that, like, my people are killing my people, basically, you know, like, mi gente, like we're killing each other and you know, I know it's, you know, has to do with greed and you know, like, the power structures and shit like that. But it really does strike me as it does break my heart. Like, it breaks my heart. And then, you know, how you're talking about the kids that are being sent to, you know, different different areas in the United States, like, that fucking kills me too, you know. Like, here are some kids that are being told, you know, like, you do not matter, like, we're just going to isolate you, and we're going to hold you until we decide what the fuck to do with you, because you do not matter, because you don't have a fucking piece of paper or whatever the fuck it is that you need to be a part of the United States, you know, like, yeah. So there's,
yeah, it's fucking crazy to me, like,
yeah,
we've been, we just moved to this town, like, while all this shit started. Like, our town, the week I moved there, made the national news for literally driving away a bus full of children, like, making the bus turn around and take the kids somewhere else. So I'm like, yay! But, like, it's so like, I grew up in Central California. It's tons and tons and tons of Latin Americans, mostly Mexicans, in, like, every, like, from the migrant worker all the way to, like, you know, fifth and sixth generation business owners, whatever, like, it's just always been. And, yeah, like, there's racist assholes everywhere, but it's really, like, there's Mexican people everywhere. So, you, like, no one's going to be, like, a jackass to Mexican people right in front of your face because it's not acceptable. But down there, even though there is exactly as many Mexican people, if not more, it's, like, expected that you're going to hate them because they're, like, invading and, like, all this really, like, charged language that's, like,
yeah.
And you're, like, you're talking about a child, man. Like, these
yeah,
are children.
Kid,
my,
man. Like, it's the kid.
Yeah, my husband was at a restaurant with my daughter, and this lady was going on and on, and he was like, I swear to God, like, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do to not say something to her, but then her friend finally told her to shut the fuck up. Like,
yeah.
The assumption that that would be appropriate or okay, like, that you just expect people are going to agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I it's really weird.
I want to say just real quick, Stacey, that I do, and I know Renee does, we really appreciate you opening up about that and your passion on the subject and how honest and open you're being about that, because it's really refreshing to hear someone talk so passionately about something they care about and that is so close to them and that they're trying to, you know, educate people about and write about. So thank you so much for talking about that with us.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
yeah, one I would add to that, too, because I feel like maybe I'm very aware of it because of where I live, and probably the same for you because you're, like you said, like you're, are you, wait, I'm sorry, are you in El Paso now? Is that what you said, or
I'm
did I make that up?
No, I grew up there. I grew up in El Paso.
Okay.
No, you're fine.
Sorry.
Yeah, I grew up there. That's basically where I was raised.
But I guess part of me wonders, like, does the rest of the country care about this beyond, like, what they see on Fox News, or do they, I don't know. Like, Jessica, you're out in Kentucky, is this a thing that's, like people are really talking about? Is it really being covered on the news? Or is it, like, a talking point, like, oh, yeah, that's still happening?
That specific issue is not as much because, I mean, you know, I'm completely in the Midwest. And it's something, of course, everybody knows about, but it's not as pressing. Now, the more talked about thing in this area is the migrant workers and that kind of thing, because we have a lot of farmland. That's what we
right.
do here. So that is an issue that we talk more about, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's been, like, most of my experience with, like, I live in California. The whole middle, which is where I grew up, is farmland. And then down in Southern California, there's oranges and whatever, orchards. So, like, migrant population has always been a thing. But it's just crazy to me now being closer to the border and having people just, like, being so hateful. Like, it's so foreign
oh, yeah.
to me.
Oh, yeah. Like, something, you know, if someone feels like there's a threat to them, you know, from taking something away from them that they've, you know, always felt that they've had, they don't necessarily that. Know that it's, like, a privilege to them or whatever, but, like, if someone
yeah.
feels a specific threat, and in the instance of, you know, migrant workers, I don't know, you know, apparently it's taking away jobs or something. I'm not even sure what the rhetoric
yeah.
is for, you know, for hating.
Is what it is. Like,
literally, they're doing nothing is what,
yeah.
And I don't understand it myself, because they're just like, hey, I would love to help provide for my family, and we're like, fuck you, but, you know.
People become it seems people that are more threatened become more vocal. That's what I've
yeah.
you know, I have found even in, like, personal encounters, you know, people
it's
will
the,
be more vocal.
Yeah, and that's what doesn't make any sense to me about it is, like, how can you be fucking threatened by these people who either they come here, like, they have not, like, my husband used to live, like, right, like, on the fucking border. And this is funny, but he lived across the street from the bar. So he would be stumbling home from the bar drunk and, like, see people coming over the border through, like, this, like, estuary with, like, a fucking black trash bag full of their stuff and, like, their kids with them. It's like, how can you be threatened by that? They have nothing. And they've, like, just risked their lives. And, like, worse, like, the people who are paying the coyotes who may or may not deliver them, who may or may not kill them, who may or may not rob them, like,
mm-hmm.
I just don't get it. Like, what is there to be afraid of?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it comes down to at that point, like, if we want to talk about that, like, what it comes down to at that point, like, that's what's, you know, that's the internalization of white supremacy. But and I can have that conversation for a long time, but, you know, I think that's what that essentially comes down to as well. So the idea that, you know, brown bodies coming in is a threat, but also, you know, because they are brown bodies, like, that is, that's another form of a threat to, you know, people who, I guess, are, you know, the nicest thing I can say are simple-minded and can't comprehend what, like, empathy or sympathy or, you know, feelings are, you know, just can't comprehend past themselves, don't understand the world past their own views, past, yeah, just.
Yeah. I think it's pretty amazing that you even tried to find a kind way of putting that. So kudos to you. High five.
Oh, thank you.
Like, I mean, maybe you didn't know that you're allowed to swear on the show, but you totally are. So.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah. Like, I just...
that was, like, her only question when I booked her was, can I swear? I'm like, yeah, it's fine.
Because you could call them fucking racist assholes, and I'd be cool with that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we are now. We're, like, out of time, and I hate ending on such, like, a bummer note. Like, oh, wow. That's,
oh, yeah. No, okay, wait. We can end it on everyone be so excited about Ladybox, because all the women that are involved in this project are amazing. It's such an honor to be a part of it. Constance Ann Fitzgerald is going to start her own press called Ladybox, and anyone who identifies as a female can submit to it when she's ready for that. I'm sure she'll let us all know or give us all more info on that. But everyone, please, please, please be so excited about Ladybox, and I'm so glad that y'all are interviewing more of the writers that will be involved in it. And thank you so much for interviewing me. Like, it's been a good time.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
We
thank
had a great time. Thank
this.
You so much for coming. It was super cool. And like I said at the beginning of the show, our sponsor this week is once again Keeping the Record by Travis Richardson, who actually, along with Constance Ann Fitzgerald, read last weekend at Books and Booze Live in San Francisco. They were both wonderful. We interviewed Travis about this book, but I'm going to read one of the 5-star reviews that he received, and this is by a person who's called Jay Shepherd. A page-turning riot, an enjoyable read, highly recommended. Keeping the Record totally cracked me up. Plenty of action with ego-driven characters on a collision course. Pure, enjoyable pulp. Fallen baseball great Roy Brands is a hilarious, flawed character hanging on by a thread. I laughed out loud many times reading this book. So, you heard it from Jay Shepherd. You heard it from us. You can go back. You can listen to Travis's episode. Or you can just click the banner at the bottom of the page, and it'll take you on over to Amazon. You can read some more reviews. You can buy the book. Music this week is Big Fish by Cambriana. And next week is Patrick O'Neill, right?
Yeah.
Author of Gun Needle Spoon. And that one should be a fuck ton of fun. So, once again, Bria, thank you so much.
It's a lullaby. Yes, sir.